Committee on Energy to order. This is our first meeting. This is the third session that we've had a House Special Energy Committee. Last year, Representative Foster and Representative Pruitt chaired it. The year previous, our first year, was Representative Edgman and myself, and so I'm really glad to be back. And it's really great to have Representative Isaacson. He brings a really interesting perspective to the things that are really struggling with up in Fairbanks, so I'm glad. And I'm glad Representative Nagaik's here, too, also. So with that, members present, we have Representative Foster, Representative Hughes, Representative Higgins, Representative Co-Chair Isaacson, Representative Josephson, and Representative Nagaik. At this time, if I could just ask folks to silence their cell phones. The time is 8:05. Today we're here to talk about a long-term supply of cook inlet energy. We have some presenters that will be talking about some of the issues that we have in the rail belt when it comes to gas supply, so I'm excited to hear what they have to say. I want to introduce my chief of staff, Jeff Turner, who you in the energy business already know, and Dave Tallarico, which is Representative Isaacson, Co-Chair Isaacson's staff. You can raise your hand. There you go. And then, of course, we have our recorder and our woman who is working on making sure that everybody teleconferences in perfectly. So thanks for being here. So we're going to start the meeting with my mayor, Mayor Dan Sullivan. I'd like him to make some opening remarks. He's been kind of taking the lead when it comes to cook inlet energy. He has a mayor's energy task force that we've been a part of. Just really working on what's going to happen if we do run into any shortages. So with that, is Mayor Sullivan on the line? Okay, Mayor Sullivan, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, take it away.
Thank you. Thank you, Co-Chairs Millett and Isaacson, and to my former mayoral colleague, Mr. Isaacson, congratulations on your new position, and you've got a big challenge in front of you. I appreciate this opportunity to talk about what is one of my top priorities, and that is securing a long-term energy future for South Central. And I know that same concern extends across the state, and so a lot of us mayors are in kind of the same position, either costs that are very, very high or a shortage of fuel. When I first came on board as part of the top priority, we did create the Mayor's Energy Task Force, and what we did was really kind of work backwards. We looked at what is the worst-case scenario, how do we plan for it, how do we make sure that if there is a disruption that we're truly prepared. And we spent the last 3 years doing tabletop exercises and working with utilities, the producers, the large users, to make sure that everyone knows just exactly what their responsibilities are in the case that there is a disruption. And as recently as this last December, we had temperatures low enough and a gas supply that no longer creates the pressure that it used to, that we came close to having an incident. And so this emergency planning has been very, very important. But what we want to do is not have to get into emergency mode. We want to get into more of a preventative mode. And a couple things we've been working on. One, of course, is conservation. And we've been doing our Energy Watch conservation drill for several years now, hoping that if we had to call on the public to participate by turning things down, turning things off, that we could actually maybe even save the day. And conservation does work. 2-4% drop in load on a cold winter day could actually save the day. But beyond that, we worked very effectively, and I want to congratulate the legislature, Representative Millett, and your work in 2010 to get complicated oil and gas bills passed in a 90-day session. I think it was one of the legislature's finest moments, HB 280 and SB 309, incentivizing new drilling in Cook Inlet and the gas storage facility. Very effective legislation. The gas storage facility came online this year. It's not fully loaded yet, but by next winter, we'll have a storage facility that we can draw on when we get those cold winter days. And I think, as we've all seen, there's tremendous activity in Cook Inlet. The problem is activity and production and deliverability are two different things. And so we're at a point now where we're looking at options to get molecules into the system that may not come from Cook Inlet. And I think you're going to hear from some of the folks testifying today about some of the thinking in that regard. I do want to our concern is that particularly the winter of 2014-15, the utilities do not have gas under contract that gives them the confidence that they can do the job they're supposed to do, which is provide heat and light to their customers. I did have a good meeting yesterday with Hill Corp. As we know, Hillcorp has purchased both Chevron and Marathon's assets in Cook Inlet. They're a very aggressive, very proven operator, and now that the regulatory concerns, I think, have been pretty well satisfied, as soon as the ink dries on the sale, they're going to be surveying utilities to find out just what their gap is in terms of supply and doing what they can do to fill that gap. And again, they have a great track record of really getting into some of these older fields and producing, you know, the last molecule available. So very confident that they'll be a key part of this solution. With that, I'll conclude, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Isaacson, and thank you again for this opportunity. You're going to get a lot of great information today, some of the stuff that we heard a couple weeks ago at the Energy Task Force. So look forward to working with you on solutions.
Thank you, Mayor Sullivan. Does anybody have any questions for the mayor before we sign off with him? No? Okay. Thank you, Mayor Sullivan. We'll keep in touch.
Thank you so much.
Our first presenter today will be Bill Van Dyke with Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska. Bill has a very storied career. He used to work, I think I first met him when he worked at DNR, and so he's very knowledgeable, and I'm excited to have him here. So with that, if you could just state your name for the record and who you represent and start your testimony.
My name is Bill Van Dyke. I work for Petrotechnical Resources Alaska, and I'm down here at the request of Municipal Light and Power to present the PRA study results.
Okay.
Just to begin, Pete Stokes from Petrotechnical Resources Alaska is the primary author of this report. He is traveling out of state this week, so he sends his apologies, but he couldn't be here, so I'll go through the study. I'm quite familiar with it. Some of you may have seen some of these slides in the past. Pete's made numerous presentations beginning in October, so he's been trying to get the word out. The slides are numbered in the lower left. Y'all have copies so we can sort of keep track of where we are. Slide two shows the study results and what the intent of the study was. I'm going to just focus on the first bullet. There are speakers behind me here on the agenda that will address really the last two bullets on slide two. PRA started studying Cook Inlet gas supply in 2010 at the request of the utility group. The 2010 study was obviously to look at Cook Inlet gas supply and then also to look at other studies that were out there that addressed Cook Inlet gas supply and just see how the studies matched up, if there are any disconnects, where they were similar, where they were not. Department of Natural Resources has done a number of studies. And the PRA study and the Department of Natural Resources study, when you just look at proven gas reserves, the numbers are very close. I mean, the differences are just insignificant. The DNR study then it's a little broader. They looked at probable reserves, possible reserves, contingent resources, you know, other categories of gas that may be in the inlet. But the utility group is interested in proven reserves, because that's what you execute contracts on. You know, utilities don't want to sign a contract on gas that may not be there. A producer is not going to commit to a firm supply contract with gas that they're not sure is there. So PRA focused on proven reserves, and that's really where the utilities are focused also. It's interesting to know what other gas might be out there, but what we need to know is what are the proven reserves.
Representative Hughes.
I'm very sorry to interrupt. We don't have the right PowerPoint here. We have a different one than what you're looking at.
The Cook Inlet Natural Gas Supply?
No,
let's take a one.
Okay, let's take a brief at ease and see if we can get some copies real quick.
That was slide three. Again, you know, the focus is on proven reserves. Slide four just shows one of the DNR studies. The blue part of the graph is historic production, and then the rainbow of colors are the production forecasts for different categories of gas. The dark orange or reddish orange is really what we would consider the proven reserves in that forecast. The light orange, the green, the yellow, the gray are not proven reserves. That gas may be there, but that gas may not be there either. And so in the DNR study, you know, the comparison we looked at was sort of the dark orange red part of the forecast, and it it matches up really good. Some of the light orange may be proven reserves. It's tough to do material balance calculations in Cook Inlet because the water coming into the gas table is also, and that affects the material balance calculation. If you don't get it right, you think there's more gas there than really is there. Slide 5 shows just one of the comparisons between the PRA study and one of the DNR studies. You can see the red bars and green bars are pretty close together. I would call those differences really insignificant. Slide 6 shows the 2010 PRA study summary. The blue line and the blue diamonds are the production, historical production and production forecast through 2020. The green, big green squares are where we need to be as far as gas supply goes. You can see there's by the time you're out there at 2020, there's a big difference between what we need in supply and what we forecast production is going to be. Slide 7 is another DNR study. Again, they were looking at some costs. What's it going to take? How much investment are we going to need to get gas supply where we need it to be in Cook Inlet? Again, I would caution we would not consider the green part of that production forecast or the gray part to be proven reserves. So if you're a utility and you want guaranteed gas supply, you really can't count on the green part of that production forecast or the gray part or even all of the orange part. So 2012 PRA was asked to update the study again, look at new wells that have been drilled the last couple of years, and just see as a result of drilling and compression where we are as far as gas supply. It looked like from 2012 study results, we forecasted the shortfall. Back in 2010, the shortfall was predicted to occur as early as 2013. Now it looks like it's going to occur as early as 2014. As a result of some additional drilling and compression. Slide 9 shows the PRA production forecast for the individual fields, actual production, forecasted production. This is the base case. It assumes no additional wells are drilled from today forward. Just take the existing stock of wells, the existing compression in the fields, and let it produce. And so slide 9 is what I would call the base case. With no added investment. Slide 10 shows a little bit about where our gas goes on an annual basis. I won't go through the whole list, but I would just note that it's not just the gas utilities. The oil and gas fields use quite a bit of gas for fuel to run the fields. And of course, Tesoro, the refinery, uses gas also. So it's not just a utility issue. I mean, I think you may have seen in the press where one of the oil fields had to shut in last month because they couldn't get enough fuel gas. There was a shortage of fuel gas, and they actually had to shut in oil production. So it's not just a utility issue. And the plot shows about 80 BCF is the expected demand over the next couple of years. And then when Donlin Creek Gold Mine starts up around 2020 on this graph, demand and cooking up for gas will go up. Slide 11 shows just the utilities. Previous graph demand was about 80 BCF a year. Utilities are about 69 BCF a year. And the utilities are very much reliant on natural gas. There really aren't that many alternatives to. There's some hydro available, but it's primarily a natural gas driven utility market. Slide 12 shows how much gas is under contract. So the green bars are existing contracts that are in place. The red bars are gas that's needed but not under contract. And for utility, it's all about having gas under contract.
Representative Isaacson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So would you tell us, especially for those of us not from the Cook Inlet area, by being under contract, why do we have this declining utilization? Would you explain?
The green bars are gas that the utilities have under contract. Producers have agreed to supply that gas, a certain amount on a given year. And it declines because production from the field is declining.
It's just from all the following field. The slope.
Yeah, and that's just Mother Nature.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do things to, you can drill additional wells, you can add compressors, but these fields are, have been producing for decades now, most of them, the big gas fields. It's just, it's like the oil production on the North Slope. It's a decline.
Yeah, I understand. No, it's just that it looked like there was more gas, but just not under contract. But you're, this is demand and not necessarily available gas.
It's correct. You're, through the chair. Correct. It's benchmarked against demand.
Yeah, thank you.
Not supply.
Yeah. Trying to wake up.
Okay. And just to note, we've been joined by Representative Hawker, who's also from Anchorage and very knowledgeable about the Cook Inlet gas supply, and he'll be here to ask some questions. We had a recent announcement from our Commissioner of DNR, which kind of contradicts some of the things that we've been hearing from you and from Mayor Sullivan about the, what the true and actual gas supplies are in Cook Inlet. So we'll probably be asking a lot of questions about that. It's very concerning that we have two groups of people that one say that there's we're awash with gas in Cook Inlet, and then another group saying that our, you know, we have gas, but we're just not producing any of it. So it's disturbing for those of us that live in Cook Inlet, because this has been the ongoing debate between the administration and what the utilities have been saying. And so, you know, my point of having this meeting is to point out the fundamental disconnect that we have with those two opposing views. So I've asked Representative Hawker to join us because he's a resident expert on some of these things and the author of the gas supply, Cook Inlet Recovery Act, and some of the things we've talked about, gas storage. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but go ahead, Bill.
Thank you. Slide 13, and this shows the natural decline of the gas fields. So you can see that individual fields are shown in the different colors on the plot, and it's all, they're all in decline. It's a result of the depletion of the gas from the reservoir. The pressure goes down, deliverability goes down, the volume remaining in the reservoir goes down of gas. So, and we're showing about a 16% or 17% annual decline, and that's a pretty steep decline rate to chase. I mean, we're losing tens of millions of cubic feet of deliverability each year as a result of the decline. So it's, you're gonna have to find a lot of new gas just if you wanted to keep production flat, let alone increase it, because you have this base that's always in natural decline. Every year it's going to decline more and more. And so you're going to have to replace that decline with more and more new gas every year, even if you want to just keep production flat.
So on that point, Mr. Van Dyke, can you kind of clarify what the disconnect is between what DNR is saying as a, you know, unlimited supply of gas in Cook Inlet when we're talking about a 16% decline? It doesn't, for me, it's frustrating because I'm not getting a straight answer from the administration, but I hear from not only the PRA, but I hear from every single utility, you know, we're talking about a reality of importing gas into Cook Inlet when we have a group of people telling us that, no fear, we have more gas than we could want. Yet you just stated the decline rate is 16%, which is phenomenal. Gas contracts that are expiring in 2013 and 2014. For my constituents, that's a scary thought. Not only does it mean, you know, rolling brownouts, possible blackouts, but it also means the importation of LNG. So do you have any indication of what the disconnect is?
I do, and it's not so much a disconnect as a different approach to the studies that were done. DNR looked at a lot of what if or theoretical situations. Theoretically, how much gas could be in Cook Inlet? Not that it's been discovered or that it could even be developed and produced, but just theoretically, how much gas could be in Cook Inlet? Likewise, hypothetically, how much of that gas that's theoretically there could be produced? So they have a lot more categories in their study of potential gas resources. They looked at proven reserves, just like we did, and our numbers are very close there, as I stated. And the utilities, again, are interested in proven reserves. They would like to know theoretically how much gas could be in Cook Inlet, you know, hypothetically how much of that gas could be produced in the future. But at the end of the day, it comes down to what can the wells produce next year? What can they produce in 2015? What can they produce in 2020? It's not theoretically, if we drilled a couple hundred exploration wells, how much gas might we find?
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I sincerely appreciate the opportunity to raise a question in your committee here. Thank you all for the indulgence. I'd like to put even a more pointed question to you, refining what the Chair just asked you. You know, yesterday, one more time, we heard from the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources that the prospect of sizable Cook Inlet gas reserves coming to market, you know, they would undermine the need for other long-term solutions. You know, and again, now I'm interpreting, but it's what I've been told by the department regularly. Don't worry your pretty little heads. We've got plenty of gas in the inlet. That prospect's going to take care of it. It's undermining any real need for a small diameter gas line from the North Slope or the import option that's being investigated by all of our utilities. And ask you as a professional, Mr. Van Dyke, who's looked very carefully at this, and a very pointed question for legislators, particularly those of us representing South Central Alaska. Would you bet your community, the energy security of your community, on the prospect, those speculative prospects of major gas finds in the inlet and major gas development at this time?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, no, I would not. I mean, utilities need a guaranteed gas supply, and a probabilistic study of how much gas is in Cook Inlet is not a guaranteed gas supply. A lot of you might remember a well named Mutluck that was drilled on the North Slope. A lot of money spent, billions of dollars spent. There's no oil being produced in Mutluck today. I mean, the oil just wasn't there. People thought it was, but it wasn't. You may remember Sunfish out in Cook Inlet, the ARCO Sunfish development. A lot of money spent. Jackup rigs brought into the inlet to develop it. There's not a drop of oil being produced from Sunfish. So it's those prospects, those exploration leads, gas behind pipe. That gas may be there, but it may not be there either. Today I would not, as a professional, count on that gas being there. And I'll show you a slide. We did some analysis. Let's add significant gas volumes to the Cook Inlet and see if we can produce our way out of that. About four slides back in the deck here, I'll show you that slide. And you'll see from the slide result, it's very difficult to produce our way out of the predicament right now.
Representative Hawker.
I'll wait for the next slide, for that slide.
Okay. So I guess I just want to sum up what you're saying is that I mean, we are headed, and we are actually already in a position where gas supplies are critically low for Cook Inlet and for utilities. And what that means to those folks that depend on those utilities to provide light and heat, you know, we're already in dire straits. I mean, we're not. This isn't, something that we should have worried about this 5 years ago, and we've been talking about this for 5 years, but been continued to be told that the gas supplies in Cook Inlet is one of the most prolific fields, but yet we still continue to have a 16% decline in production in Cook Inlet, which for me is probably one of the biggest things facing my community. And not unlike any other community in the state, but I feel like we've really kind of been I don't want to say I just feel like we haven't gotten the straight scoop, and so this is kind of what we want to talk about and go over and make sure that people understand that importing LNG is a possibility if we don't get an in-state gas pipeline to provide that gas supply that's sorely needed for the Cook Inlet. So, I'll let you continue. Sorry.
Okay. I have a question.
Representative Higgins.
The two wells you mentioned, what was it, Muckluck, and what was the other one?
Sunfish.
Sunfish, that's right, Sunfish. When were those done? Muckluck was the early 80s?
Okay.
Sunfish was
1990s? Okay. Well, I guess my question is, as we go forward in technology 10 years ago compared to today is completely different. And so when DNR comes across and says, well, there's plenty out there because of the science we're looking at, and we're relatively sure it's there. So I guess my point is, you don't trust the science behind that?
Through the chair, Representative Higgins, I wouldn't categorize DNR's position that they're relatively certain it's there. I mean, these are probabilistic studies, 10% chance there's so much gas, 50%, 90%. I don't think they're saying that gas is there because the wells haven't been drilled and the gas has not been discovered. It's a probabilistic study, and there's nothing wrong with those kinds of studies, but I would not use those studies as my business plan if I were a utility. I mean, utilities just have a higher standard that they have to look towards.
Okay.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you again, Madam Chair. Well, segueing off of the question that was just asked, let's fast forward to the current present day using state-of-the-art present technology in the Cook Inlet. Are you in position, are you able to give us a bit of a briefing on the Fury Escapada story of the past 12 months? I seem to recall a year ago or whatever it was, they were drilling in the Cook Inlet, they made an announcement of a find of 3.5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, a mega find. And I believe at this point in time, none of that has been proved up. Nothing's available to the market. And if I remember right, it's been reduced to a maximum estimate of like 0.75 TCF in place, let alone producible. Am I anywhere close?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I'm only aware of what's out there, in the public, and I would agree with the numbers that you stated. Fury has been pretty quiet, since they drilled their wells. So, PRA does not have any of that gas incorporated into its study as proven reserves, by any means.
And as may I follow up?
Follow up.
And as professionals, if you felt that it was appropriate and relevant to your future projections, you would have included it, would you not?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, yes, we would have. We've included everything that we, in our professional opinions, thought was proven gas, proven reserves.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
So slide 13 was again, the base case, existing facilities, existing wells, produce them out into the future. Slide 14 is a case where we took the base case, and I'm sorry, slide 14 is also the base case. And I just want to explain the graph because then on the next couple slides it builds on this graph. So in the plot, the red line across the horizontal red line is the demand, and that's total Cook Inlet demand.
Okay.
We're on slide 14. The blue line is the production forecast for the base case, and then the red bars are the shortfalls. And you can see there's a lot of red ink in this base case as you go out into the future.
I just have a question. In your professional opinion, looking at that gap and the shortfall, what's going to fill that gap? Obviously, if we're drilling is going to take a certain amount of years. I mean, we're talking, we need gas in 2014, gas contracts expiring. I mean, what is going to fill that gap?
Madam Co-Chair, it could be a number of things. We could accelerate production in the existing fields. I mean, just drill some more wells in the existing fields. You're not making the pie any bigger. You're just eating the pie you have a lot quicker. So you could accelerate some gas that was going to be produced in 2020 by drilling additional wells in the existing fields.
you could accelerate that gas up to 2014 or 2015. You might solve the problem for the next couple years, but then in 2020 or 2018 from that accelerated production, then you're in real trouble. Then the red bars for those years are going to be a lot bigger. We could have some exploration gas online in the next couple of years, certainly from the Kenai Peninsula, you know, where there's more road access, more pipe, existing pipes. A little bit of exploration gas, again, accelerated gas. So there's the possibility, and I'll show you the next two graphs where we add some gas, like exploration gas or accelerated gas.
So this is just probability gas.
Right.
Again, speculative.
Yes. And we have been finding a little bit of gas every year, adding some new wells, and slide 15 shows that. You know, slide 15 shows the number of wells that have been completed over some time periods that are shown on the plot. So most recently, there were 8 gas wells completed. They averaged about 3.6 million cubic feet a day. So we added, round numbers, you know, close to 30 million cubic feet a day of gas from these new wells. But the decline rate was about that much also. So, you know, at best we held our own, and because of the decline going forward. And then these wells are also going to decline also, so it doesn't get any better going out in the future by just adding these 8 wells at around 3 million a day each. And so we anticipate there's going to be some additional drilling. You know, the base case assumes no drilling because you have to start with a base case, but then you want to look at these scenarios. So slide 16 is a scenario where you took the base case and you added 10 million cubic feet a day for each of the next 7 years. So in 2013, we added a new 10 million cubic feet a day from additional drilling. And then in 2014, we added another 10 million a day from new drilling, all the way out over the next 7 years. So we added about 150 billion cubic feet of gas to the Cook Inlet gas supply in this scenario. And this might be, you know, some of the gas DNR talks about, exploration gas, behind pipe gas. We think some of that gas does exist. And so the utility to ask for a scenario like this where you're adding 10 million a day, which is a very reasonable assumption. I mean, I think the explorers and the developers will add at least as much gas, new gas, every year. But there's still a shortfall, even if you're adding 10 million a day for a 7-year period. And slide 17 is a similar scenario. You can see, again, on the plot, the red is the demand, the blue is the forecast, but we added 20 million cubic feet a day for each year over a 7-year period. So we added about 350 billion cubic feet of new gas to the inlet. That's new gas over and above what we have today. That's a lot of gas to add 350 billion cubic feet. It's not as big as the numbers Representative Hawker talked about, but it's a significant add. And you can see that we still don't produce our way out of it. The shortfalls are less. There's no shortfall in 2014. There's a smaller shortfall in 2015. But there are still shortfalls. Even trying to produce our way out of the predicament we're in. I think this scenario adds roughly, in our opinion, about 70% reserves to the existing proven reserve numbers. So it's an increase of 70% in proven reserves. Can the explorers and developers do that? I mean, I think there's a good chance they can. But again, they have to find the gas, they have to get it developed. And even if they do that, there are still shortfalls. And I think that's the message here, that the base case looks pretty dire, existing well stock, if you just rely on that. If there's a lot of activity, adding 20 million cubic feet a day each year for 7 years, there are still shortfalls. And I think if you can appreciate the numbers on slide 17, you will appreciate the predicament.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Van Dyken easily understood English then. With all of these scenarios, with the current activity of exploration and development, what's the realistic picture for expanding the current supply? Is it 10? Is it 20?
I think, through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I think it's somewhere between slide 16 and 17. I mean, the utility group is using sort of an average of the two. Some are adding maybe 15 million cubic feet a day, new gas each year for 7 years. So it's sort of the average of slides 16 and 17. But again, in either case, there are shortfalls. Not that things could be better. I mean, there's a possibility that things could be better, but I would not use that as my business plan. I mean, I think slide 17 is about as far as you want to stretch the rope.
How fast do you actually make a contract then with any of this proven? Is it almost immediately? I mean, let's say Buccaneer finds something or Renaissance finds something and they say, we've got this gas, mad dash by all gas parties in Cook Inlet to see who gets the contract first. Could you explain that?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, someone's going to have to go out and find the gas, you know, drill the first well and prove that there is some gas there. They're probably going to have to drill another well or two to delineate the reservoir and confirm that the size of the reservoir. And then then they'll go through the permitting process, the development process, make the final investment decisions. And along the way, start talking to the utilities about gas contracts.
The timetable. What's the timetable for that?
Well, I mean, onshore on the Kenai Peninsula, 2 or 3 years, probably you could get something done if it's close to the road system, close to the pipe system. On the west side of the inlet, it's going to depend on really where the find is, how close to the pipeline system. You know, there are some roads on the west side of Cook Inlet, but not too many. A lot of them got beat up pretty hard last fall in the floods. You know, some bridges got washed out, so there are some challenges on the west side. Maybe 3 or 4 years if it's a big discovery and remote. Maybe 2 years if it's, you know, on one of the road systems. So some of this gas could come online in the next couple of years.
And one last question then. So just to be real clear, this shortfall graphs that you have in each of the models, that accounts for the lag time from discovery to permit to basically getting it to the utility.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, it does in a fashion. I mean, it's not a direct calculation. It just adds an additional volume of gas each year beginning in 2013. So the 2013 gas that was added, you know, that development had to be finished by 2012. And there were some wells drilled in 2012, so there will be gas added this year.
So this is a realistic time projection. It's not an optimistic one in and of itself. The decline of the shortfall, let's say.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, it assumes that there is ongoing exploration every year, that the exploration, delineation, development continuum is always in motion, that every year folks are exploring, every year folks are discovering gas, and every year folks are developing gas. And we've seen that in the slides, slide 15. I mean, it does show there are wells being drilled every year, wells being completed, new gas coming on, just not in the volumes that we need to get rid of the shortfall.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And again, Mr. Van Dyke, can we just flesh this out and a little bit more, too, for clarity to myself? You know, it's real easy for us to look at, you know, the charts here that say, you know, over the course of the last year, 8 gas wells were completed. I mean, that's empirical, easy to see, easy to talk about. And then we talk about the assumptions in your own modeling here. You know, we go to page 16, 3 to 4 new gas completions added, then to 17, 6 to 8 new gas completions added, you know, showing the consequence on deliverability, which still falls short. But you know, it's so easy for us to hear, oh, 6 to 8 gas wells. That's easy. Let's just go out, you know, it's just going to happen. What's the probability of that being accomplished? And I guess and also, are you able to address, you know, we throw out the names, you know, Hillcorp, Buccaneer, Armstrong, Apache. From my understanding and talking to all of these companies, with very few exceptions, they're not looking for gas. They're looking for oil out there. So what is the both the probability of 6 to 8 new gas completions changing people into targeting gas? And secondly, can you turn that 6 to 8 gas well completions, which are easily understood numbers, into the amount of additional cost and investment that it would require to do that, let alone, and we're talking 6 to 8 new successful gas completions here. So could you talk a little bit more about, you know, some of my random concerns?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I do work with Municipal Light and Power and help with their interest in Beluga River gas field, so Hillcorp and ConocoPhillips are our partners there. So we have a lot of interaction, and I do some work for some other Cook Inlet companies. So, I mean, I think the 6 to 8 gas wells is very realistic. You know, we're talking with facilities and things to go along with the wells, probably $75 million investment each year to make that well set happen. You know, it's going to depend whether they're onshore on the Kenai, onshore on the west side, offshore. The costs vary significantly. But I will agree with you. I think oil is where the money is, and, you know, just in absolute terms. But the gas market is, I'm a gas consumer. You know, Matanuska Electric customer and NSTAR customer. I think gas prices are going to go up. I mean, I think the gas prices will be more attractive to the explorers out into the future. As a consumer, that's not exciting to say, but I really do think, you know, gas prices will be higher 5 years from now than they are today. I really have no doubt about that. So I think folks will chase gas. The economics are there. It's just the return is not as good as it is for oil. But I think Hillcorp will be out there doing some work related to gas. Cook Inlet Energy, likewise. Beluga River Unit, I think you can count on that. We'll get some work done.
And were all of those that you just cited developing those existing proven reserves, as you mentioned earlier, just faster production out of what we already know is there?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, it's a mix. I mean, there will be some infill drilling in existing fields. We won't get into all the complex geology, but there really are probably some gas pockets in existing fields that are not producing right now, just as a result of the way the sand bodies, the reservoirs are laid down in those reservoirs. And there'll be some exploration for sure.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question to begin with is how much LNG has Alaska imported since gas first was developed in the 50s?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, LNG
yes.
Imported to Alaska?
Yes.
None that I know of, right. Sir.
And what can we expect the price to the customer to be if or when we import vis-a-vis what they're paying now? Do you know what that would be?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'll let some of the speakers behind me maybe address that as far as the utility group is certainly looking at options, LNG imports, CNG, compressed natural gas, ships, trucks, boats, barges, trucks on the North Slope, and there's a study underway, and so I'll let those utility heads speak to that.
May I follow up? There are any number of other types of fuels that we import and have for decades, is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Sure, I mean, a lot of liquid fuels get imported, propane gets imported, no doubt.
So my last question, I guess, it sounds like there's, along with being a real problem, that is this decline, which you suggest is not entirely correctable in the short term. Is there a political, it sounds like there's a political dimension to this, that a great oil producing state shouldn't be importing LNG. Is that part of what is sort of the undercurrent of what's going on?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I had a chance to review Commissioner Sullivan's slides from yesterday, and there, I would say it's, you know, maybe importing gas to Alaska gives us a bit of a black eye. I'm not sure, you know, if it does or it doesn't, but if it's the choice between a black eye and a blackout, I'll take the black eye.
Thank you.
Mr. Van Dyke, can you, I guess this would be a better question for the utilities, but just talking about importing LNG and what the cost to the consumer, what that would do to the cost of the consumer, rather than producing from our own fields, I would imagine that importing LNG, we've been appreciating some pretty low gas prices in Anchorage and in the rail belt, but what with the importation of LNG, what does that do to the economics of my gas bill?
Co-Chair Millett, I'll defer to the utility.
Okay.
Personal opinion is the price will go up.
Substantially?
I'll let the utility speak to the
okay.
amount of increase, but I think it will go up.
Okay. You can continue.
Okay. Slide 18 is just the map off the Division of Oil and Gas website. Talks about some of the exploration possibilities as well as the infield development. We've sort of touched on that, you know, trying to there is that possibility to accelerate production in the existing fields and to develop some what folks might call behind the pipe gas reserves in existing gas fields. But and I think as slide 17 showed, it's going to be very difficult to produce ourselves out of the predicament we're in.
Mr. Pandek, you keep using the term the possibility, and I guess I would like to know the probability. Possibility is a nice word and it's optimistic, but what's the probability of this of us getting out of this decline? I mean, is it a realistic thought that we can curb a 16% decline before 2014 and not be in a situation where, like you said, choosing between, you know, blackouts, rolling brownouts? I mean, I like the word probability, but, you know.
Co-Chair Millett, as I said, I think the results on slide 17, you know, where we're adding 20 million cubic feet a day for each of the next 7 years, is, like I said, that's about as far as I would want to stretch the rope as far as probabilities, possibilities. And it shows that there is a shortfall, and I think the utilities need to, they're studying, you know, ways to address that. I would not personally, you know, assume any more added production than shown on slide 17, and it's not enough, unfortunately.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, slide 19 talks about infield development. We've touched on that. There are some opportunities there, but all I'll say is really, I don't think, again, there's not enough supply just as a result of infield development work that we're going to produce our way out of this predicament. We can accelerate the production and maybe do away with the shortfalls in 2014, 2015, 2016, but then we've just doomed ourselves for, you know, 2018, 2019, 2020, you know, because the pie isn't really getting any bigger. We're just eating that pie up a lot quicker. Slide 20 is exploration. Again, certainly folks are out there exploring. There's, I think, some gas will be found, but again, I'm not counting on 300 BCF of gas, new gas being developed, or 500 BCF of new gas being developed as a result of exploration. I think there'll be a lot of smaller gas fields found. I hope there's some big ones found, because that's what we need, but I wouldn't put it in my business plan right now.
Mr. Van Dyke, from the time that exploration happens to the time that production is flowing through the pipes, what is that timeline for new fields, not existing fields that you can produce more gas from, but from new fields? What's the timeline from exploration to delivery?
Coach Millett, again, on the Kenai Peninsula, maybe 2 or 3 years till you find it, delineate it, develop it, and get it online.
If everything goes perfect.
Right, and your permits, permitting's been going good and cooking. Mm-hmm. you can stay off the federal lands. So
it's 2013, and you're saying a couple of years, and we're out of gas contracts in 2014. So even with new expiration, even with that timeline, we're talking about new gas getting online in 2016 at the earliest.
Coach, there are some wells being drilled right now and have been drilled recently. So I talked about that continuum, exploration, delineation, development, production. We have some of that is in the mill, so we'll have some new gas next year as a result of that, some new gas this year. But that whole continuum of exploration, development, production needs to continue.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hughes.
Yes, I maybe missed something or need clarification, but I thought earlier you said in order to get up to that point where they'd be adding 68 new wells, it would take about $75 million investment per year. And I'm looking at slide 19. I'm seeing some money going out, Hillcore $203 million, and these other things happening. So wouldn't that indicate that they're on track to do that, or are we missing a piece?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes. In part, that's correct. Hillcorp is spending a lot of money, and I think has plans to continue to spend significant amounts. I believe, for the most part, they're chasing oil. They have some plans on the gas side of the business also, and so does some of the other explorers. But I think, for the most part, that money is chasing oil rather than chasing gas.
Follow up. So I know it's all connected, but so the $75 million per year would be more directed specifically at gas, because if they're at $203 million and they're looking at $150 million coming up, can you just talk about how I don't know if you can separate it out. So are you saying $75 million specifically targeted for gas?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes. Yes, and the question was, if you're going to drill these six or eight wells, what would they cost? And again, it's going to depend where they're located, onshore, offshore, west side, east side of Cook Inlet. But that $75 million was just sort of a round number for those gas wells. And that wouldn't necessarily all be Hillcorp, because ConocoPhillips is out there, Municipal Light and Power is out there paying its share of expenses at Beluga River. So Armstrong, Buccaneer, it wouldn't necessarily all be Hillcorp spend.
Representative Parker.
And Madam Chair, thank you for indulging me here. I have to run off to another meeting related to Cook Inlet gas supply. But one of the other items that's been raised, I'm addressing this to your committee, ma'am, if mm-hmm. that's all right, yep. Through the chair, members of the committee. One of the issues that has been, or one of the statements that is being made characterizing it, is that additional gas from the North Slope through any diameter pipe will add the prospect that it will derail plans for additional exploration in the inlet. And I can tell you all, last session when we were working on House Bill 9, we had letters of support from all of the major Cook Inlet explorers, producers, that stated that additional gas in the inlet is a good thing. It would not compromise their efforts to move forward and explore. We're working on getting those letters updated this year. We'll provide them to your committee. And I'd like to debunk the statement right up front that more gas in the inlet is bad for the inlet. It creates a bigger, stronger, dynamic market for everyone. And then, Leslie, and I'm going to be disappointed to miss having an opportunity to talk with our utilities, but I personally have been working with our utilities for the last 2 years, and I'd ask you very strongly to drill down on them. Are they willing to place our community at risk in the reliance upon the Department of Natural Resources claim that, don't worry our pretty little heads, these shortages come and go, and this one is just another one of those times? Please drill down hard on those utilities and find out what they think needs to be done and what their concerns are. Because I don't know about you, but they're the ones that are delivering my gas, not the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hooker. Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I know time's running short. Maybe just skip to slide 22, and it Just one comment on the gas line, North Slope gas line. You know, I personally think we're going to have a gas line somewhere out there in the future, so maybe 2022, 2025. And the point is, it's not going to be soon enough to alleviate any shortfalls in 2015 or 2018 or 2020. You know, we probably all have our own personal opinions of when that project's going to happen and how it's going to happen, but I think we can all hopefully agree it's not going to happen in 2015, and it's unlikely it's going to happen in 2018. And there are going to be shortfalls in Cook Inlet gas in those years. I think the utility speakers will cover most of these other slides. Slide 28, the conclusions. I mean, I hope you appreciate the predicament that we're in with this Cook Inlet gas supply from the reserves and numbers standpoint. The utility groups will give you some more information on what they're looking at as possible solutions, but I hope that you appreciate that the shortfalls, at least we believe, are real, and they're significant enough that we need to address them, and we need to start now. Thank you.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Van Dyke, thanks for your testimony, and just to put a synthesis on a couple of the issues that we've discussed here before the other speakers come up. In your estimation, we've heard that imports are going to cost utility users more in Cook Inlet. My concern, just by the way, imports don't necessarily give us a black eye. They de-incentivize production in Alaska, and that means our workforce in Alaska goes elsewhere and doesn't return, as we've seen with Agrium, what we've seen with other things. We're watching in the interior with oil refining. Flint Hills has shut down two towers because this ridiculous idea that we should be chasing imports for competition's sake, without looking at the nuts and bolts of development costs in Alaska and incentivizing our product for our people. Nevertheless, having an increase in cost because of imports, and because we have the idea that whatever the market will bear, we should be able to permit anyone to gouge us in pricing. I have my own retail gas story for you, if you like, from North Pole. But the idea is, my question is, do you expect, even if we can't get our own production online in time to meet your shortfall needs, and we bring in gas from overseas, will the price ever go back down for Cook Inlet and the ramifications that has statewide?
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, that's a tough question. I think exploration and development and production in Cook Inlet is always going to be competitive against the price of imported gas. I mean, I think the explorers and producers in Cook Inlet will, to the extent they want to continue to operate in Cook Inlet, will be able to. Imported gas is not going to drive them out of business, you know, as a result of low prices of imported gas. Where the market ends up as far as gas prices, I'm not sure where that will end up, but I mean, your observation is one possibility, you know, that local prices will match imported prices. I mean, there are some classic economic theories about that. Yeah, I'm not going to testify that I can tell you today where Cook Inlet prices will end up, but I think the imported gas prices will be high enough that local native Cook Inlet operators, you know, folks that are out there drilling and producing, will be able to operate and make a profit. It's imports, you know, should they occur, will not drive folks out of business in Cook Inlet.
Mm-hmm.
Representative
Higgins.
One last question. On your slide 23, LNG from the North Slope, you know, large number of truck deliveries to meet your shortfall. Can it meet your shortfall?
Through the chair, Representative Higgins, I don't know. you're talking about, you know, ice road truckers on steroids. You know, it's, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of trucks, you know, probably 700 or 800 truck drivers that don't exist today, lots of trucks. It would be a huge challenge to try to meet Cook Inlet shortfalls by trucking off the North Slope. Not that it couldn't physically be done, but, you know, it's a lot of gas, it's a lot of trucks, it's a lot of truck drivers. It would be a, the Parks Highway would would be lined with trucks going both directions.
Well, so then basically, I would follow up on that. Uh-huh. So basically, then that's not an option, is what you're telling me.
Through the chair, Representative Higgins, the utility group, maybe some folks behind me here will speak to that. It's one of the options that's being looked at, but I'm not sure it's the most feasible option. Again, physically, not that it couldn't be done.
Mm-hmm. Representative Isaacson?
Well, follow up to Representative Higgins. If that was put on the train, as the railroad is looking at it, the trucks being brought to Fairbanks and put on the train, then that's a more conceivable scenario if our liquefaction plant is large enough on the North Slope.
Through the chair, Representative Isaacson, I mean, that's another permutation of that scenario, certainly. It's more handling, you know, it's more equipment, it's trucks to Fairbanks and then trains to South Central, so it's... It gets the trucks off the road in South Central, but it's more handling, actually.
Representative Hughes.
And back to the truck, if we were to truck them down, the logistics and the number of trucks you mentioned, how would that impact the cost to the consumer compared to importing gas? Would it end up being more because of...
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I'll defer to the speakers behind me on the actual prices, but it's not going to be a cheap option. I mean, as I think you're probably aware, you know, it would require a big liquefaction plant on the North Slope, a big gas conditioning plant, and then lots of trucks and lots of truck drivers, and fuel for those trucks, and maintenance.
Thank you. Mr. Van Dyke, any closing statements or...
No, again, if you have follow-up questions, Pete Stokes will be back in town next week, and I can convey the questions to Pete, or if you want to contact Pete directly at PRA. Thank you for your attention.
Yeah, thank you very much for your presentation. At this time, we're going to invite up the long-term gas supply group, which is Moira Smith from NSTAR, Jim Posey from MLMP, and Brad Evans from Chugach to give us an update on their long-term gas supply study group. And you should have a presentation from them also in your packet. And please let us know if you don't have one. We'll get one to you.
This one?
Yeah. And just for the record, if I could have each of you state your name and your affiliation.
Bradley Evans with Chugach Electric.
Moira Smith with NSTAR Natural Gas Company.
Jim Posey, MLMP.
Thank you. And I don't know how you've worked it out, but please feel free to begin.
Thank you. Co-Chair Millett, Co-Chair Isaacson, members of the committee, thank you so much for inviting the utilities here to speak with you about the Cook Inlet gas supply situation. First slide is worth having a look at just to see who is on board and who is actually working together to try as a utility group to confront, address, assess the problem that we're facing with Cook Inlet supply. Before my time, there may have been a little bit of internecine warfare between utilities, but I'm happy to report that we are working very closely together on this because it is so critical to all of our future. Now, somebody outside referred to the mind-numbing Cook Inlet supply scenario, and I am going to present you with another slide, but the thing to know about this slide and this decline curve is I want to give you our perspective and what we see when we look at this slide. It's not just sort of a, you know, hopeless decline curve that causes us anxiety and sleepless nights. The anxiety and sleepless nights comes from the fact that we were granted certificates of public convenience and necessity from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. We were given the honor, frankly, of serving South Central Alaska with their gas needs. NSTAR, speaking solely for NSTAR, has been serving Alaska and South Central since 1961, only using Cook Inlet gas supplies, not using any imports from any place else, including the North Slope or Lower 48 or anywhere else. it is NSTAR's primary goal to continue to do that, and to do that at a price that's reasonable for South Central customers. But when we look at this, we see the need to ensure that whatever gas we get, we continue to get, so that we can continue to reliably serve South Central customers, and so we can ensure that the lights stay on. Now, this, again, is what Mr. Van Dyke just presented to you, and this is the middle case. This is between the base case and the optimistic case to which you referred. The reason why I mentioned this one is because it does, as he pointed out, anticipate the addition of additional production. And Co-Chair Isaacson, you asked how quickly after gas comes into the pipe and starts flowing, the utilities contract for it. And I can tell you that in NSTAR's experience, particularly over the last 6 months, it's immediate. I mean, and it may even be pre-immediate. It's as soon as we can get the darn stuff. And Mr. Wilcox of Cook Inlet Energy lives a couple blocks from me, and I've told him that as he gets gas online, or, you know, I'm going to put up a tent in his driveway and ask him every morning so I can be the first one there. We're not wasting time. And there are clearly the utilities and producers have commercial arrangements to make, and those are, you know, complicated and difficult and not always pretty. But we are cutting through the chase, and there's a lot of strong cooperation between utilities and producers at this time to ensure that whatever additional production comes online is put under contract and delivered to your door as quickly as possible. I wanted to talk a little bit about CINGSA, and Representative Hawker was here. I'm sad that he's not here to sort of see some of the fruits of his hard work. The Cook Inlet Recovery Act included a provision for this gas storage facility, the Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage Alaska facility, which was built and is operated by NSTAR. We have three customers, Chugach, MLMP, and NSTAR. And we built it in anticipation of needing additional deliverability. And it's important to understand the difference between a volumetric shortfall, which means how much gas is produced in the year in Cook Inlet and can be delivered to utilities, versus a deliverability shortfall, which is on a given day when it gets really, really cold, how much gas do we need on that day? And that's the deliverability piece. So we knew we would have a deliverability problem where the wells wouldn't be able to ride our swings when it gets really cold. We didn't know, however, how much we would need CINGSA this winter. It went into operation in April. Injections began in April. Withdrawals began on November 9th. And as early as December, this is what a week in December looked like in terms of NSTAR's actual profile.
Representative Isaacson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Myra, I've forgotten your last name. I'm sorry.
Smith.
Oh, Smith. Easy. Because this is being televised, and a lot of folks may be new, and we've got, a lot of us are freshmen, could you do a quick summary of CINGSA?
Sure.
The Cook Inlet Natural Gas Security Act.
Absolutely. And I will let you know that CINGSA will be doing a separate presentation just for your information on Friday at 3:30 to the Senate Resources Committee to give a little bit more of a fleshed out background. But so what CINGSA is a depleted natural gas reservoir, or almost depleted natural gas reservoir, in the Cannery Loop unit, very close to Kenai, sort of underneath the Kenai River, just south of the city of Kenai. And it, what we did is we hired some of the best people in the industry to come in and assess what reservoir would be best in all of Cook Inlet to help do exactly what CINGSA is doing, which is to help meet daily deliverability needs. They selected this reservoir, and they began drill work in 2011 and completed it and got it going in April. And so what they did at that point is they injected two kinds of gas, is the way I like to think about it. One is the pad gas. That's a gas that will stay in the reservoir for all time until the reservoir quits being used as a storage facility. And that's CINGSA's gas. And then there's the working gas. And there's 11 BCF capacity of working gas. And Chugach, MLMP, and NSTAR each have a certain contracted quantity of that working gas that they inject and that they can then pull out on any given day. CINGSA was done and was completed and conceived specifically to address the deliverability challenge. In other words, CINGSA will not solve a shortfall problem. It will not solve a volumetric shortfall. But what it helps us to do is to make sure we can deliver gas on any given day. And that's really what this slide illustrates. It got awful cold last year. You may recall from seeing the reports that it was the second coldest year since 1982. And as a result of that, during December, 5 weeks after the facility went into operation, we were drawing on CINGSA to meet NSTAR's basic needs. So if you look at December 17th, just as an illustration, on that day, our total overwide system demand, or overall system demand, was close to $225 million, and around 60 of that was coming from CINGSA. Now, that's not academic. NSTAR has a gas bid system. Every single day, we go out and we ask producers to bid on gas. We say, hey, we need $20 million, and then they come back with bid responses. And I can tell you that every day this winter, we have not gotten responses that have met the bid requests that we have sent out. So on this given day, on December 17th, we sent a bid request out. We got bid gas back. We paid not insignificant amounts for that gas. And we still had to dip into CINGSA to the tune of $60 million for that day. So this is how close we are. Some people say we're already living the shortfall. I think certainly from a deliverability point of view, that's the case. From a volumetric point of view, we like to think we can hold on until 2015. But this is how close we are. And the one other thing I'll say is, and these guys have much more experience about it than I do, is that what we don't have in Cook Inlet is a lot of redundancy. We used to have kind of flex points like Agrium and like the LNG plant. We used to have a lot more production. So if production slowed, or you know, a particular compressor went down, or a field had problems, a well, you know, whatever production hiccups which occur, right? I mean, we know that happens. We used to have redundancy and some backup, which allowed us flex points. We could say, hey, Agrium, you've got to hold on so we can ramp up production or ramp up deliveries to the utilities. We don't have that anymore, except in the form of CINGSA. CINGSA is our flex point at this point, and thank goodness it's completed on time, under budget, and is performing as designed.
Representative Nagek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the reservoirs are not owned by the NSTAR, you have the purchases, then you have the withdrawals. So then, those withdrawals are from a reservoir that you don't own, or somebody else does, or.
Representative Nagai, through the chair, are you referring specifically to CINGSA?
Yeah.
Yes. Through the chair, the NSTAR's sister company, CINGSA, now is. I'm a lawyer, so I can't say anything easily, owns the reservoir that this is located in and has contracted out capacity to the different utilities.
Follow up. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the purchase, or just separate from the, I'm trying to get a handle on that, on the withdrawals and the purchases.
Representative Nagai, through the chair, what the utilities do when they pull gas out of CINGSA is they remove gas that they have already put in. So it's different from all the other fields that you talk about in Cook Inlet, where the producers own them and the producers produce as they see commercially fit and economically fit. This is one that is owned by a public utility, CINGSA, and that is used by the utilities as a way of meeting their everyday need.
So like an emergency fund or something?
Kind of. It's a very good source of insurance for us.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that the storage capacity was 11 BCF, and on December 17, you needed 60 MCF. What's the current, volume that's in CINGSA right now?
I can only speak to NSTAR. NSTAR has about 3.4 BCF as of last Friday. None, I will just note that neither CINGSA nor any of our customers were able to fill up their contracted volumes last summer as planned. MLMP got there. They got there a little later than I think planned, but they did get there. So NSTAR was not able to fill up its contracted capacity because of a lack of gas last summer.
Thank you.
And to that point, what's the probability of this summer being able to fill up the capacity of CINGSA? I mean, we continue to see the supply of gas dwindle. First use of gas goes to consumers, and I would imagine that CINGSA's down the line from that. So what is the prognosis for being able to fill that a storage facility next summer?
I would say it's dependent on a lot of variables, including weather, including to a degree commercial decisions made by the producers, to a degree the LNG export facility and the plans surrounding that. And I will also tell you that we're working as hard as we can to do it. The important thing to recognize about CINGSA is that what it allows you to do is put gas in to the reservoir in the summertime when consumer demand is quite low,
right.
That otherwise in the past producers had to turn down or simply was not available. Mm-hmm. So it does allow, or excuse me, the demand was not available at that time. So it does allow us to sort of even out producer supplies. And that's a little bit what you see in this chart. If you can tell, the blue part is what we actually purchased from our producers. That's essentially flat on a daily basis. So the swing, to the degree that it occurred on those days because of weather variations, and NSTAR is tied almost directly to weather, came off of CINGSA. And that's why I describe CINGSA as being the flex in the market.
So could you talk about if we continue to have some pretty cold winter days? I mean, that's always been the big fear, is that if we have a long period of, you know, below 10, 20 degrees in Anchorage, the demand is significant. At what point, I mean, the pad gas has to stay at a certain level, I'm assuming, to keep the storage facility operational. At what point, I guess, what's the cold day supply of excess gas and CINGSA to cover so we don't have to move into those positions of rolling brownouts or going into the mayor's, stoplight, I mean, where are we? What is the potential? And I know you've taken that scenario out. If say, February is the coldest month in history and we really do have a deliverability problem, how much is CINGSA helping you, and when is it not?
Well, to a degree, I want to defer to my electric brethren on that. The CINGSA is contracted withdrawal quantity is 136 million a day. Because of a lack of pressure in the reservoir, we're not quite there this winter. So you can see, I mean, I think on the biggest day, Chugach also withdrew during this period. And I think on the largest day, we had about 70 coming out of CINGSA. But if you had production failures, or if one of CINGSA's compressors were to go down, or both of its compressors were to go down, then we would be in a diesel situation. I mean, CINGSA can only help us so far. And, of course, if you look out over the spring, if we got really, really cold in February, you'd be depleting your working gas inventory. And so, again, if March were unseasonably cold, there is a possibility we could, NSTAR could deplete its CINGSA volumes and be unable to meet deliverability challenges.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Higgins.
Just a question on CINGSA. When you dip into that, does that cost more to the utility people that have it? Is that seen on their utility bills?
Yes, the way the CINGSA rates are structured, there's a reservation fee to just sort of rent the space in the reservoir, but there is an injection withdrawal fee. So that does absolutely add cost. It's a good question.
So,
Representative Nangyak?
So it just costs more to get it out when you need it?
Yes, through the chair, yes.
And it's charged passed on to the consumer?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Any other questions?
Okay. So people have not been sitting idle. There's been a lot of work done. We already referred to the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. The screen represents operators that are out there with whom we speak on an absolutely regular basis. And there's drilling going on. It is impossible for us to divine by looking at Hilcorp's stated drilling intentions or spend intentions how much of that's going to go to oil, how much of that's going to go to gas, how much of that is going to go to plays that would bring us both, or would bring us one or the other, or some combination of the two. But we do know that people are actively working, that gas wells are being drilled, as PRA has reported. So a lot of work has gone into this so far. We also, utilities have taken sort of matters into our own hands to a certain degree. We built CINGSA, it came online, it is being used, as I've described. These gentlemen can tell you about South Central Power Plant and Fire Island.
Okay. We did.
Can you state your name on the record?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
This is Bradley Evans with Chugach Electric. Yeah. We have been taking other paths to help cure the problem, arrest the demand side. You know, we're talking about the supply side mostly here, but there's also the demand side. So we've been taking steps to diversify, and there's been a big CapEx spend on that side. We recently brought on one of the state's now largest wind farms, and we do use that to offset fuel, which we can then put into the storage system. So we try to maximize the benefit of the storage in coordination with the wind that we see. A larger capital spend was the South Central Power Plant, which, depending on what you compare it to, is either about 25 to 35% more efficient than the generation that it replaces. And that came on, our first turbine spin there was on Alaska Day, and it also helped us get through the winter. A 25% reduction in our demand is, gas demand is a tremendous help on this. So we're working both sides of the equation, and we're spending money on both sides of the equation. With that, coupled with some expansion at some hydro, conservation and efficiency, we're looking at 2015 for our own native requirements and at Chugach, about a one-third reduction in gas demand, which we think is a tremendous untold story that shows that we've been taking this problem seriously for quite some time, not just concentrating on the supply side, not just concentrating on somebody else solving our problems, but taking that matter into our own hands and doing what we can on our side of the business, and working with the mayor and all of those other things there. So those were significant adds. All of these have been taken into account in the analytics. And as far as the analytics, we have, counter to what DNR said the other day, that our study doesn't include development of new resources, and it's only the decline curve analysis of what exists. I hope you understand that that's just the base case that we add on the other production to. We try not to be overly optimistic in that, because I think that runs counter to our responsibility to our members and citizens. And we end up with something more along the line of middle of the road type analysis, and it's still showing the shortfall, even with the new gas, even with all of these other offsets. And we continue to work on these offsets, and we'll add to them. All of those turning gears have been added into the calculus of our analytics, and we're still showing a gap. So I think the big concern amongst everybody is our concern for the gap versus somebody else who doesn't have a play, doesn't have a dog in the fight, so to speak, saying, well, you can just wait and have this other stuff play out. Well, we've been working that side too, but I think that obligation to our membership and our responsibility perhaps dictates a different path forward than what other people are recommending we do. We're considering all options on the supply side as well, and I think you've heard that before, whether that be the trucking model, which we have seriously taken a look at. We don't have enough answers on the trucking model to know if it's a clear winner or would be the choice. We're still in the middle of all the analytics on some of the things that you'll see coming up, and we're not at that decision moment yet, but we're getting close. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Maura.
Mr. Evans, I have a question. When we talk about the decline in Cook Inlet and how you base your business model, how crucial are we getting to that point where, even with all the options that you're considering, is South Central in peril? Are we at that position where, I know you've been working hard. I mean, the Mayor's Energy Task Force has been working hard. Your working group has been working hard. But I think that we've been hearing two different sides of the story, one from the Department of Natural Resources, which, as Representative Hawker stated, isn't the ones that are delivering the gas to my house, compared to what you and your utilities have been talking about for the last 5 years, about this is becoming an issue. And I don't think that we've raised the issue in the legislature enough until, recently, to talk about what the expectations are for, you know, keeping the heat and lights on in you know, the largest populated city. So if you were to measure where we are in importance of really addressing this issue, I mean, I would assume, and I've always come to the conclusion, especially when we first started this committee, was that we are at a crucial point, and realistically looking at importing LNG, trucking, whatever else we have to do. It's gotten to a point where we have neglected to address the supply in Cook Inlet to this point now, where we're, you know, solutions of last resort.
Representative Millett, co-chair, and I think myself personally, you know, my history, I've been down here for years talking about this problem. We've been doing the capital spend on our side to do what we can, and we've had our eye on this for quite some time. And I think myself personally, I think I fell prey to the optimism of the Cook Inlet Renaissance and probably delayed some decision making by a year. But if the kernel of your question is, do you feel that you need to make a decision now, then the short answer is yes, I need to make a decision now. I barely have enough time to put a rational play into play, a rational decision into play. I think the schedule may dictate a less than optimal solution because we are short, and I can take the hard knock for that. I was part of the team that's been sitting here watching the dial on this thing. There's been lots of people, but you can put your finger in my chest and say, you know, you should have made that decision sooner. If I wasn't an optimist, I probably wouldn't show up to work.
Right, me too.
The short answer is the decision needs to be made now, because the science, the analytics, the calculus, the data, all the experts that we rely on, it's still showing a shortfall that needs to be dealt with. And I apologize to the state of Alaska if we put in something that's less than optimal for all the different stakeholders that are out there. I don't have a silver bullet that makes it right for the members, makes it right for the state of Alaska, makes it right for DNR. But I think it was put eloquently before, you know, that I'm going to have to take the black eye versus the blackout.
So my next question to you is, do you think that the public is aware of where we are? You know, I talked to some of my constituents. They understand where we are, but the most part, people go flip on their light switch and they think it's going to work. But the general consensus that I get is that people don't understand where we really are in our energy supply for South Central. They don't understand the dire situation that we're in. And when we do go to the point where we're importing LNG, it's not a decision that anybody has taken lightly. It is a import or blackouts. And so do you think that the public has we're trying to have a hearing now so people understand that. Do you think that there's a general understanding with your membership on exactly where we are in our energy supply situation?
Co-Chair Millett, I think we've done a really good job of communicating to our membership, and I would say that there's a high penetration of understanding that there is a problem. But I agree with you that there's not an understanding of how it happens, why it happens, what's being done about it exactly. There's a lot of science, there's a lot of engineering, there's a lot of finance stuff swimming around this issue, market issues and things like that. And I think that's where the understanding, you know, goes down. But I think that our membership, certainly Fairbanks and people we serve with Cook Inlet Gas up there and things like that, I think they understand there's an issue there. But I think that it's not well understood exactly how it happened, exactly why it happens, and exactly what the cure should be. So there's still some education that goes on, but we publish in our own membership publications monthly. We've been doing this for years. We take advantage of a lot of the public meetings that we go to speak to this. So the awareness of this has been, it's been building quite a lot, and I would say it's hard, you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody that doesn't know there is some sort of fuel supply situation in the Cook Inlet that's going on. I can't really say what the depth of their understanding is of it.
So the mayors, the tri-borough mayors have gotten together and done the stoplight. can you just give us a rundown on when we did have those tabletop exercises and we did ask folks to power down? What were the results? Because I think if you look at the results of how those tabletop exercises played out, I would assume that we could do much better if people understood the gravity of what we're talking about.
Sure, Co-Chair Millett. The results of that were, I believe personally, and this is an opinion, is that they were somewhat muted because we hold them in the fall. And, you know, a 5% effect, a voluntary effect by people who would like to participate in that, and that's a voluntary program, your gas demand isn't very high then. So a 5% effect there isn't the same as a 5% effect when you're on peak. You know, the delta would be bigger there. Percent per unit would be the same, but the amount of demand that you're reducing that 5% would be greater because it's a greater number. So I think that they were successful because if it's it partially answers your first question about how much does the membership understand. If we can get at that time of year a notable, measurable response from the public, that means the public's aware of the problem. If they thought this was just for fun and games, I don't think anybody would participate in it. So there's a general awareness that this is a serious situation in South Central, and people are taking it seriously. We started the program, the other part of your question, we started the program about 3.5 years ago, I think, now. And it's just one of those things where we said we need to practice just in case instead of practicing after the case. I want the parachute before I hit the ground, not when I hit the ground type thing. And we have lots of steps that we go through, inter-utility coordination about how to reduce demand. We have a lot of other tools in the toolbox that we delineated in the plan, whether that's rescheduling hydro, it's drawing from SINGSA, it's firing oil fire generation, it's buying from Golden Valley and things like that. So there's a list, a laundry list of things that we do before we even get to asking for the public curtailment or voluntary curtailment. Before we get to, we're going to have to take matters in our own hand and rotate to reduce the demand.
We had a sheet that you gave us a couple years ago that mm-hmm. talked about what would transpire. If we could get that to the committee members so they can understand, you know, when we talk about how that plays out for the citizens that are on that. Representative Higgins.
Help me understand, because I'm not on gas. I'm from the interior, heating oil. What percentage of gas goes to your turbines, and what percentage of gas goes to heating the customers for their, you know, for their heating bills?
I think we have that going.
Yeah, I think it's slide 10 in PRAs. Yeah. I unfortunately don't have it to show on the PowerPoint, but it illustrates gas demand. And so,
what page are you on?
I'm on slide 10 of the PRA study.
Oh, PRA.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. There's two interesting things to note here. One is the third bullet down, the third largest user is oil and gas, fuel gas. That's field operations. So when Mr. Van Dyke referred to XTO, a producer, shutting in its oil platform, that's because they couldn't get field gas to keep their operations going. And then the bottom one, of course, is Tesoro.
Right. So we're looking at, follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
So we're looking at 13% from Chugach. I'm just throwing that out there because that's there. You know, there is private enterprise out there, that's a lot of utilities, that are trying to put energy on the grid. They're having a hard time doing it for whatever reasons. And from what I'm hearing is that you guys need all the help you can get. You need all the extra energy that people are willing to give you. So we should be able to have this private enterprise put energy on the grid so that you could help you on your end. So where are we at with that? I mean, do you see a problem there or a disconnect or what?
Through the chair, Representative Higgins, that's a very complex question, and if you have the patience, I'll do my best to answer it. we have engaged private industry. The Fire Island Wind Turbines was an IPP, and that is the audience that you're speaking to there. And so we're definitely not opposed to that. We have a standing RFP to ask for people propose projects to us, and that we're asking them propose projects that are not fossil fuel based, because if they're just going to add a turbine, which many people would like to do, that burns natural gas, it's not really helping to your point. So we're open for business on that, and we've encouraged
other developments like expansion of the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Plant. We're proposing a project down there to divert Battle Creek, which is another drainage into that, which would add about 10-15% to 18% more fuel in the fuel tank. It's energy, water, and that's not the private industry you're referring to, but we're engaged in a lot of different areas to try to encourage diversification in our portfolio, reduce our reliance on it. I think we had some scenarios where we studied where we took all the electrics completely off gas, but we still have a problem. So at some point in time, the reason I testified to the commission, I said I want a gas solution to this, is because I'm a gas customer of Instar, and so we use that. I appreciate all the differences between an oil-based platform that you come from yourself. You know, we have cases where we use oil fire generation, thing like that, and we have opened ourselves up for that. One of the projects I've personally taken on is in our area we have a multi-ownership of the grid system, which depending on where you want to put that project in, it becomes a barrier because of all the people you have to contract with to get it to the customer. So we have a project to unify the grid that would help facilitate that. So it's a work in progress, but definitely our shop's open. We have a standing RFP on our website, and we've entertained a lot of people coming through there. And like I say, we have the leading edge example of evidence that our shop is open for business.
Mr.
Go ahead. Paul, well, I appreciate that, and I'll pass that on to these private enterprises that you guys are open for business and are willing to look. So I'll keep you to the word on that. Thank you.
Mr. Evans, at this time it might be good to describe the difficulty of getting excess capacity from Fairbanks, let's say, down to the Cook Inlet on the transmission lines. Would you just review that real quick?
Certainly, Co-Chair Isaacson, I'll do my best to answer that question verbally, although it would certainly help to have a picture up on the board. The rail belt's comprised of sort of three load centers, three communities, the Fairbanks, the South Central Mat-Su area, and the Kenai Peninsula. Between these areas, we have very, very small, weak interties. So if a project were to occur in the Fairbanks region or South Central region that was an alternative to gas-fired, we have difficulty moving it to another community in a large-scale way because of the limitations of the ties in between them. And we have projects that we're proposing to strengthen those ties so that each region can help the other region out if there is a problem. I could drill into that more, but we can't transfer all of the capability of one region to the next region. It's like there's a lot of traffic that's got to move through a little dirt road, and it doesn't work too good. And so we've got some projects on the drawing board to try to turn those into four-lane highways, and which would help facilitate your earlier question about the IPP coming into the system, other hydro resources and things like that. We do need to strengthen the grid to be able to move energy around.
And an optimistic timetable for completing an intertie such as you're talking about, the four-lane highway, how many years are we looking down the road?
Ooh, you know, Co-Chair Isaacson, that's another really tough question. And the thing that that always messes me up on these predictions is the permitting process and what land you're going through, and the being certain that you can say that I know that I can get a permit in a year. It's been my experience that that's sort of a roll of the dice about how long it takes to get a permit depending on what you're doing. We're struggling with that now. We're trying to strengthen one of the interties right now today. We have people working out in the field. Thank you for the grant. And permitting has become an issue even on that one, where it delays the project and things like that. And I'm not blaming people for doing their jobs. They're doing their jobs, but it takes some time. So depending on the scope of the improvement, I would say once you've arranged the financing, it's a 3 to 5 year process.
Thank you.
So you probably picked up on this, but we've reached the bottom line, which is that we need to supplement Cook Inlet gas production. The rest of the slide is really critical. in our ideal world, whatever solution we come up with would avoid discouraging new cook inlet production, would be scalable to market needs, so that if a TCF of gas were found in cook inlet that could supply us for multiple years, we would be able to turn the spigot off, would create price signals that would encourage local supply, and be flexible to allow for a portfolio of future options. That's our ideal. Now, I can tell you that we have not so far in our process found that ideal, but the closest approximation is very expensive. Any import project would involve capital investments that would have to ideally be amortized over a significant period of time. So if you say, do an import project, but make sure it's only 5 years long to ensure that the impact on the market is as minimal as possible. And again, number one is avoid discouraging production in Cook Inlet. But if you say make it 5 years, then the capital expenses have to become amortized over that short period, or you pay a very expensive escape clause in those contracts. So the group has been working very, very hard for a number of years to address this, and has turned to looking at various ways to supplement Cook Inlet gas. We sent out requests for information to multiple entities, and the options on the table right now consist of three marine CNG providers, so compressed natural gas providers, three marine LNG providers, liquefied natural gas, and then the possibility of LNG trucking from the North Slope.
Smith, can I ask you a question about the when you talk about the importation of CNG or LNG? We're talking about, obviously, if you don't want to disincentivize Cook Inlet, you're talking about short-term contracts. Is there a difference in price that the utilities will pay with a short-term contract versus a long-term contract? And can you talk about how that will affect the cost to the consumer if it is a short-term contract versus a long-term contract?
Chair Millett, the short answer to your question is stay tuned, because and I hate to give you that answer because I want to be straight with you, but our analysis will be done in February.
Okay.
And we will be making decisions likely in February. What we are looking at now is every option, and also how to manipulate each of the options to optimize flexibility. So let's say, for example, this is a real case is that we received a proposal from a marine CNG shipper that was based on a 15-year contract, and it cost what it cost over the 15 years, and you know, allowed everybody to make a fair return, and those costs would get passed on to consumers in a way that we consider to be economic to South Central customers. If you say to them, and we did, what happens when you cut that back to 5 years, they're working on those numbers now to tell us what it would be. All we know is that it would be a lot more. That's all we can say with certainty. And the cost of any of this will be passed on to South Central customers. We've appreciated a very low-cost source of gas in Cook Inlet for a long time, but as that changes, utilities have to make additional plans, and unfortunately, the people who burn gas have to pay for it. So we have been actively engaged. We have broken down the problem into a short-term versus a long-term, in part because if you look at the possibility of a major capital investment in an import, that involves a lot of upfront work by whoever your provider is. It's going to take a few years to get that online.
Representative Isaacson?
You may be getting up to this. Thanks, Madam Chair. But Ms. White, Ms. Smith, spinning diesel, as we've talked about that again, how much can you replace, you know, you've got these three options, the marine CNG, marine LNG, LNG from ANS, but with the South Central Power Plant, with other diesel possibilities, how realistic is the fact that diesel could provide you an alternative, especially in light of the expense of a short-term marine contract?
We've been exploring that vigorously. I'm going to defer to Mr. Posey here in a moment. The one thing I will say is I always remind people that NSTAR does not have a diesel option. So this would just be shedding load from the electrics, not offsetting a molecule of NSTAR's demand. But Mr. Posey, who, as far as I can tell, at this point has the only plant that can actually burn diesel, can speak to your question.
And just as a reminder to the presenters, it's We're getting close. We have about 11 minutes left for our committee time, and I know other members have other committees that start at 10, so.
I'll be short.
Okay. So I apologize for that, but this is.
Through the chair, I have a 10 also. We can burn Representative Likes, and, you know, about 180 megawatts, which is our peak load, on a probably 5 to 9 day schedule with the oil that we have in place. But bear in mind this equipment, pipes and everything else, we just replaced the pipes, are 35 plus years old. And so therefore, every time you run it for 5 to 6 days, you're going to shut it down, do maintenance on it. And so therefore, it's not something that you can run for 20 or 30 days at 180 megawatts without the potential running to failure of some piece or part failing on you. And so that's the piece here. We are, like Chugach Electric, looking at our plant, new plants, being retrofitted or fitted to burn diesel, but that brings in air permit problems, EPA, DEC, you name it. We're grandfathered in for the most part for what we have, but anything new is a whole different world for permitting. Thank you.
And so a way to translate that is, if we choose diesel as a short-term alternative, and we have not made that choice yet, there will need to be capital investments. Matanuska Electric's power plant is a dual fuel, and so when it goes online, it will be capable of burning diesel. But again, how much load are we going to be able to shed, and what sort of a decline curve are we running from? So, as I said, the short-term need is being examined at this time. We're looking at the possibility of spot LNG imports. Diesel weather has an enormous effect. The fact that we've enjoyed warmer weather than average temperatures in Anchorage has been a big saving grace for this winter, and we're crossing our fingers we'll be able to get through.
Representative Nagyak, do you have a question?
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, do you have capital improvements tied into operations, new technology coming on to reduce costs to operations and pass that on to consumers, or do you give that consideration?
Representative Nagyak, through the chair, NSTAR does not, but I can let these gentlemen speak to their any capital requests they've made.
Great.
Representative, I apologize, Nagyak.
Close
enough. Apologize. If we make a capital investment, though that capital investment is rolled into our rates and passed on to our consumers, if there is a benefit that results from that, that benefit automatically flows with that rate adjustment as well. The prime example of that is the SPP power project, where we had to make a substantial capital investment, which gets rolled into our rates, but at the same time that reduces our fuel bill, which is also in our rates. I won't explain the details of that, but so if there's an increase in the rate because of a capital spend, that shows up, and then the decrease in fuel consumption shows up, and you know, the idea is they offset each other, but I think all of you know that when you buy the new car that gets really good gas mileage, it doesn't quite make the payment on that you owe the bank. But you accept that because you feel like you're improving things. And we are, and certainly we take this very seriously. Don't mean to make light of it. So there is mechanisms there that if we do spend capital, that's recovered, but the benefit flows to our members. We are regulated by the RCA, so they look over our shoulders, and they look at our numbers, and they're there to guarantee to the public that we're accurate in what our costs are, and that we don't pass on any additional costs that are not warranted or unnecessary.
Thank you.
So just to finish up, we are looking at a long-term solution, as intimated, 10 to 15 years, CNG, LNG, trucking from various sources, as is indicated on the slide. This is a possibility as to what our future supply scenario looks like. This anticipates significant capital investments in converting SPP to be a dual fuel facility, improving MLMPs, generation units, and relying on MEAs, diesel. But this obviously does not take into account the permitting, and the quality of life suffering that I think we would experience in South Central if we did have to experience what our brethren in Fairbanks have to suffer through, which is the burning of fuel oil. Next steps, we anticipate we're doing an economic as well as an engineering as well as a political slash regulatory analysis of all of the options that are being presented, and have engaged some stellar consultants to help us with that. We anticipate that we will get their recommendations next month, and we will look at it very critically to try to determine what is the most economic, but most importantly, the most secure solution for South Central's future.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee members? Representative Hughes?
Yes, I am looking at page 12 of PRAs, and I see there's quite a bit not contracted, about 15% in 2014, and that grows. And I'm just wondering, in the course of business, and maybe this is for Mr. Evans and Mr. Posey, how far out do you typically want to know that those contracts are set and established? And when kind of is the drop-dead date for making that decision as far as, you know, can you wait and see what's going to happen with the trucking? That page 12 on PRA, is that really disturbing? You'd like to see that red be far down the road, quite a bit farther down the road, I'm guessing.
Representative Hughes, that's a very good question. I've been asked that often, and my answer is that it will be different for us than it would be for other utilities, depending on their circumstances. We as many of the communities in Alaska are isolated. They can't call on their neighbor if they get in a problem. So their, you know, appetite for risk is different than somebody who can just pick up the phone and buy the product from somebody else. So you have to have redundancy. You have to have reserves and things like that. So going to the contract side of that, it doesn't do me any good to have extra generation and extra this and extra that if I don't have extra fuel. And we measure that in the time under contract. And my sort of rule of thumb that for our utility would be about 10 years. And the reason I say that is that you can't turn an industry on a dime. And it takes time to engage private industry with non-fossil fuel-fired options. It takes time to permit your way out of this. It takes time for you to grow your way out of this. So if I could wave a wand and be princess or king for a day, it would be a 10-year supply.
Thank you. I think you'd make a better king than princess.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you for all the presentations today. I would like to, Ms. Smith, to invite you back when you get your February results. I'd also like to have a little more in-depth conversation with the utilities and talk about contingency plans and going forward legislatively how we can help. I imagine if we get into a situation where we are in dire straits, permitting won't be a problem. I would imagine that the pressure from the public would be such that permitting would continue on a fast pace. But I do want to continue to raise the awareness of what we're struggling with in South Central, not to take what's happening in Fairbanks or in rural Alaska lightly either. But this is an issue that has been ongoing. We've been trying to work through it. I know the utilities have been very diligent in trying to work out a path forward for Cook Inlet, and also with the Cook Inlet Explorers are doing a great job. So I'd like to continue the conversation in February if that will work for you and for the committee members. But our next meeting, I think Representative Isaacson will be working on some Fairbanks issues, Fairbanks energy supply.
I think we're going to be hearing Edgman's.
Oh, right. We'll be taking up some legislation. But I appreciate everybody being here, and we will adjourn the meeting at 9:59. Thank you very much.